Thank you.
My name is Stu Bramall, man. I call it. I'm not a big book thumper, but they were talking about this theme of this thing we've been rocking into the fourth dimension of existence. And there's about two paragraphs in the big book that talk about that. And I want to read them real fast so you see what we're talking about here. And one of them is on page 8. It says, I was soon to be catapulted into what I like to call the fourth dimension of existence. I was to know happiness, peace, and usefulness in a way of life that is incredibly more wonderful as time passes. And the other place is mentioned. So over here on page 25. And it says, we have found much of heaven, and we have been rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence of which we had not even dreamed. Trust me, I'm living in the fourth dimension. That's all you're going to hear out of this. I was in AA a short time, and we used to raffle big books all the time off. And I won a big book. I was in AA about a week or two. And I told my sponsor, I got this big book. I'm walking around AA like this with a big book. He said, what you got there? I said, I got a big book. I said, everybody should have a big book. He said, well, open me up and read me a paragraph out of it. I read him a paragraph. He said, what did it say? I said, I don't know. He said, put the book down, and you go to meetings, and you talk, and you listen to drunks. Trust me, when I get a new man, I never give them a big book right away. I give them a directory. They need to know where the meetings are more than they know what the book is. And as due time comes, I will get them a book, and they'll find out that the answers for all of our problems lie right somewhere in this book. In fact, it's called text, something to be studied. And I want to thank our two speakers before. When Bill invited me, I want to thank you for inviting me down there. I've had a great time. And I enjoyed the first two speakers, Jan and Beth. Great stories. They did a great job. And I told them, I said, when I get down there, I said, I just don't want to come ahead down here and do my thing and go ahead and speak and get out of town. I said, I always look for the whole enchilada. I come for the whole thing. I like to come and I like to listen as well as I like to talk. I'm not a speaker. I'm a talker. I'm a storyteller. And so I said, maybe I could come down a day early. And that way I'll be here. I won't have to drive 2.5-3 hours in the morning. And I don't, because I don't want to miss nothing. I'm like a little kid. That's why I stay up late and I don't sleep good. I'm afraid I might miss something. And he said, come on down. I said, all I got is a, I said, maybe, he said, we can put you up in a motel. I said, no, you don't have to put me in no motel. I said, you got somebody down that's got a couch or something I can sleep on? And he said, I got a trailer, got an extra bed. I said, that sounds great to me. I said, I'd rather sleep in a trailer with some nice people having some conversation than sleep in a palace all by myself. That's what this thing's all about, the fellowship. I've been very, very blessed. I love looking out and see all the young people here. Because theoretically, by old days of standards, I was a young person when I got sober. I came to AA when I was 23. Had my last drink when I was 25 years of age. About almost 3 weeks ago, I celebrated my 42nd year in Alcoholics Anonymous, a day at a time. I got sober March 12, 1966. And by those standards back in the 60s, I was a young person in AA. Everybody else in AA looked like they were 100 years old. And I do have a home group. My home group is the Curtis Bay Noon Meeting. We meet at Monday at noon, right outside of, used to be in Curtis Bay. Now we're up the road about a mile in Brooklyn, Maryland. And we meet at a place where a lot of us guys used to drink. And we meet in an old building called, it used to be called the Flamingo Lounge. And the church bought it, made it into a community center. It still has a bar in it, and it looks like a bar. But it's a community center, and that's where we meet at 12 o'clock noon. I got sober my first year sober. I got involved, and we started a young people's group called the Under 35 Group. There's a lot of old-timers, and they went through that group and got sober and stayed sober. And now I feel like I'm in an over 65 group. Yeah, I'll be 68 next month, and we got a lot of old-timers at my meeting. I've been to Best Home Group, Midtown Group. A lot of young people. If you guys young and gals young want to see some other young people's things, so we go to that meeting. She's talking about over 300 young people being there. And I'll tell you what, I've been there. Probably 75% of them are under 30. lot of very, very successful, very good, young-looking, sober people in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, you come to my group, you're going to see a lot of old people. We've got 22 members in my home group with 478 years of sobriety. My sponsor's in my home group. I have a sponsor. I would not want to be an A without a sponsor. He has a sponsor. My sponsor will be celebrating 47 years in September. I sponsor guys in AA. And they sponsor guys in AA who sponsor guys in AA. And it trickles on down the line. We're just part of the chain. And I went to meet with a guy I sponsored named Dave about 3 weeks ago. And he sponsors a guy named Mark who sponsored Jamie. And we have four generations of sponsorship in that little car going down to a meeting in AA. How beautiful can that get? Talk about being rocked in the fourth dimension. Being a guy who was a taker of his life, to come into a program to become, be taught how to become a giver. And we all have drunks that we sponsor. And since we're talking about drunks we sponsor, I'm going to tell you about my favorite drunk I sponsored, a guy named Larry. And I got active when I got sober in AA, and I started working with a lot of drunks. And I ended up sponsoring a guy named Larry in 1972. And Larry stayed sober for 11 years. And because of resentments, not going to meetings, bad attitude, whatever, Larry went back to drinking. It took him 24 years to get back to AA. 12 DWIs and 9 driving without a license later. Prison, jail, the whole works. He came back to AA. He just celebrated his third anniversary in Alcoholics Anonymous. And Larry used to show, even though Larry went back to drinking, I ended up being godfather to his kid and everything else. And we ended up being very close, even though he went back to drinking, you know, I never turned my back on him. I remember, you know, one time when he was drinking, I get a 3 o'clock in the morning on my front door. So I go down, and there's Larry, drunk. I said, "What do you want, Larry?" I said, "Do you want to get sober?" He said, "No, I need a place to crash." I said, "You don't want to get sober?" He said, "No." He said, "I need a place to crash. Can I come in and sleep on your sofa or something?" I said, "Excuse me 1 minute, I'll be right back." He said, "What's the matter?" I went over, and I'm looking in my mirror. He said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm seeing if I look stupid. You want to come in my house and crash? You don't want to get sober?" He said, "No." I said, "Sleep in my driveway? Sleep on my, you're not sleeping in my house. I'm not waking up tomorrow morning, my TV's gone. And you're gone. I'll do anything to help you stay sober. You want to drink? See you later, baby. Don't screw with me. Okay?" He said, "Well, I'll call you when I get home." I said, "You'll never make it home without getting another DWI. He said, "I'll call you when I..." Phone rings, 5 o'clock, there's Larry. Well, I made it home. I said, "God bless you. You want to get sober, give me a call." So 3 years ago, he called me. And God bless him, went to a meeting, he's been sober ever since. And you know what's neat? I told him when you come back, I said, for the first 6 months, you keep your mouth shut and you don't say one single word except your name, you're an alcoholic. Because as soon as they call on you, all these old tapes, was 11 years of sobriety, is going to start playing. And you're going to think, what can I say to impress these people and think I'm so smart and everything else? I said, if you keep your mouth shut for 6 months, you don't have to worry about sitting there thinking what you're going to say to get called on. You can just tune in and listen. And I said, I didn't believe you told me to do that, but beginning, he said, looking back, it's the best thing I could ever do. He said, I had to do this different this time. And God bless him. He's still the dearest friend. He was going to come down with me today, but he had to work. I appreciate going to meetings. I listen to people stand at the podium and they talk about, they swore they'd never be like their parent. I swore I'd never be like my father. They say, my father was drunk and I turned out to be a drunk too. Or my mother. And I said the same thing when I was a kid growing up. I swore I'd never be like my father. My father wasn't an alcoholic. Neither one of my parents drank nor smoked. I was one of 7 children in my family. To this day, none of my brothers and sisters have a drinking or drug problem. I've got 2 children, 6 grandchildren, and 6 great-grandchildren. And to this day, there's no drinking drug problems nowhere in my family except for me. So I don't know whether I try to make up for the whole damn family or what happened. But I never met a drink I didn't like. First time I drank, I got drunk. The last time I drank, I got drunk. And every time in between I drank, I got drunk. I found something in bottled booze I never found in Kool-Aid or Pepsi-Cola or iced tea or anything. I found the answer for all my problems. I love going to meetings and watching new people come in today. Usually when they come into a meeting, they sit and they hold a cup of coffee like this. Just like when we were in a bar, sitting there holding their drink. I watch when they get sober, they start to let the cup go. And they leave the cup alone, and pretty soon they're like this. And then you can sort of watch and see when a guy's getting sober. Little things like that. And I was holding a bottle in my hand. Like, to me, this is the only friend I have in my life. This is the answer to all my problems. And if a man did to me what booze did to me, I'd kill him if I get my hands on him. If he take away my family, my self-respect, my dignity, my anything decent, nice I had in my life, I could get my hands on him. Yet I won't let a drink go. Because this is my lifeline, drinking. Anyway, getting back to my father, I said, man, I would never want to be like my father. He's just too decent. He's too honest. He's too clean. He's too respectable. I want to be like Freddie's father down the street. We lived out in the country. I love Freddie's father. Freddie's father was an alcoholic, full of action. And we'd be out. Freddie's father was AOL for 3 or 4 days. We're out looking for Freddie's father drunk. The police were always at Freddie's house. Things are getting thrown through the window. Fighting, arguing, ambulance in the drive. Always a lot of action at Freddie's house. And I just love being down at Freddie's house. To me, that was exciting. My family was just so boring. I mean, a six-pack of beer would last them a year. I mean, they just didn't drink. Their big decision was to have sweet or unsweetened Kool-Aid or iced tea for the 4th of July. And I was a late bloomer to start drinking compared to today's standards. I met some young guys here today, 16 years of age, sober in AA, almost a year. I didn't start drinking until I was about 14, almost 15 years old. And I came from a family, no drinking there was just no drinking, period. There wasn't even the question. And we're going to go to a party. And we all lied to our parents. I had a brother, and there's three sets of us brothers that ran around together. And we all lied to our parents saying we're going to stay in each other's house. And one of the guys' parents are going to be away. We're going to have a party that weekend. And we're going to drink for the first time. Now, I'm going to tell you something. I don't know how much my first ice cream costs. My first bottle of the Deerport wine cost me 51 cents. In fact, I bought two of them for $1.02. And we're going to go to this party, and we're going to drink and have a good time. We're going to do what the big boys do. There are going to be a few big boys there. So we got someone who, you know, to get us our booze, and we jump in this 1949 Mercury. We're going to this party, and I want to set up in front seat, shotgun by the door on the passenger side. I want to be able to lay my arm over the door frame, look like I got a muscle, so we can talk to the girls. Try to impress the girls. I got a little skinny arms, 14 years of age, but I want to impress these girls and lay my arm over that arm at the top of the windowsill. Try to get them to go to party with us, and they said, no, get in the bag. I got back there in the back. I drank one of Bob's wine going to the party. And I'm going to tell you what, man, my personality before I started drinking was like a piece of Swiss cheese. There's nothing solid about me at all. I was very insecure. I always felt inadequate. I always felt like I was in competition with the rest of the world. I was shy. I was bashful. I'm the kind of kid my teacher would say, come up in front of the classroom, give a report. I'm going to fail. You got to say, fail me. I couldn't stand in front of people. I go to a dance. I lean against a wall. I want to go out there and dance with Rosemary, but I'm afraid I'll make a fool out of myself. Everybody laugh at me. I'm afraid I'll step on her toes. When I started drinking, those holes filled up, and I became a different person. AA says, you want to see someone getting sober, there's more than just not drinking. We look for that profound change in personality. I went through a profound change of personality when I started drinking. I thought I was the cat's meow. My whole philosophy after that was, when I found booze, I found the answer to all my problems. And I found something that worked for me. And my whole philosophy becomes, live fast, die young, and be a handsome corpse. Let it all hang out. Just go for it. I was young. If you would sneak up behind me when I was drinking, and my head was like a coconut, if you could take a hammer and bust my head open like a coconut, it would just pop open. All you see come running out of my head is little naked women in beer bottles. That's all I thought about was women and drinking. Let the good times roll. I'd go out partying and someone said, it's closing time. I said, let's go down the ocean. And a bunch of us go down the ocean. I got married when I was 17. Most people don't get married when they're 17 unless one of two reasons. You're pregnant or crazy. and we were a little bit of both. And in 1958, when someone got pregnant, you just got married. She was a nice girl. You just got married. But I wasn't marrying material, and I didn't take marriage serious. I'd be out drinking with a bunch of guys and gals, and someone said, "Let's go down the ocean." And I said, "Let's go." And we drank all night, and we're partying, laying on the beach, the sun starting to peep up over the ocean, and I'm thinking, I didn't go home last night. I need a drink. Then I get thinking, which is dangerous for drunks. I'm already one day late, why not be two? And then 3 days. I'm already in a little bit of trouble, what's a little bit more trouble? And that was my whole attitude toward life. It was all about me. I would not want to be married to a jerk like me. So we get married when I'm 17. I get booted out of high school. I don't have a formal education. And which proves you don't have to be smart to get sober. Okay. In fact, they told us, you got any brains, check them at the door when you come in here. You know, just sit down there and become an alcoholic. And so me and this gal, Nancy, got married. Wonderful gal. Wonderful gal. Too good for me, trust me. And we got married April the 15th. And we had a son born July 20th. I told everybody he was born premature, 6 months, he weighed almost 9 pounds. My father told me, he said, that first one can come anytime. Your second child's going to take about 9 months. Yeah. And so I ended up, you know, getting booted out of school my senior year, and I had to go get a job because I didn't have a lot of education or, didn't, you know, I came from a poor family, everything else. I got a job working on the waterfronts in a factory. And second year, we had another child. So I had two kids by the time I was like 19 years of age. And the second child died after she was 3 months old. And I used that excuse to drink. If your daughter died, you drink too. And my whole thing is, as long as I can keep looking out there and blaming people, places, and things for reasons to drink, I don't have to look in here. I drank because I'm an alcoholic. I drank because I could not help but drink. I couldn't live with it, and I couldn't live without it. One was too many, 1,000 was never enough. I never had enough booze, and I used that excuse to drink, and cut a long story short, I drank, and I was an action drunk. I loved drinking in bar rooms, in nightclubs, and people said, well, how could you afford to? You didn't have no money. I used to love hanging in the Rhapsody Club in the Hollywood Palace, and where there's a band, a lot of dance, a lot of action going on, and I'm married. And she's home with the kids, and the next thing we had another child a couple years ago, but I'm out there like a single guy, you know what I mean? They said, how could you afford? I said, it's easy. I said, you just hang in there. And I said, sooner or later, some guy's going to get up, and he's going to go dance, and you're drinking out of a bottle, and you set your bottle down, and you just pick up his bottle and just, you know, keep right on moving. You don't have to buy, you only buy one drink that night, and just keep moving. And he's drunk, he doesn't, I thought I had a full bottle. Now, give me another beer, you know what I mean? You can work the games if you're smart enough. Now, new young guys, if they not stay sober, may use that down the road here. But, I mean, I'm just, might get you back here soon if you make it back. Not everybody gets back. And, but I was just a wild, crazy drunk. And my behavior got me into a lot of trouble. I found myself being locked up for assaulting police officers. I want to play King Kong when I get drinking. And Mr. Filthy, nasty. And I took on a couple of police officers one night, and I'm being locked up for assaulting police officers, resisting arrest, disorderly conduct. Then they booked me also for verbal assault. Verbal assault is when you have a filthy mouth and you say dirty words to police officers, and they charge me with verbal assault. And I even got a disorderly being booked. So I got into a lot of trouble with the police to the point that the pressure got so bad with me and the police officers and some other people in the county that I was raised in Anne Arundel County, AA County. And I always lived in a little house. I was raised on a little house on the water. And, I mean, I lived a nice life. Trust me, I have no qualms with my parents. And then I went out and moved on my own. I moved around a lot. And then because I got in trouble with the police department and a couple other people that I shouldn't have gotten in trouble with, I moved to Baltimore City. I was working in a factory right on the outside of the city on the waterfront. I never lived in a rental house before. All these houses, like right side by side, they all look the same, red brick, white stones, steps. So I moved to the city, and
I moved, eventually I ended up on a little street called Wilhelm Street, 1800 block in West Baltimore. And it's set between Fort Monroe and McHenry and Payson. And it's a high rent district, $14 a week for a house. So you can imagine what kind of house I was living in. Wife and a couple of kids. Typical row house in Baltimore City. All them houses are the same. They got you walk in the front door, there's a living room, a dining room, a kitchen, a back door, and a concrete backyard and an alley. So, upstairs are two bedrooms and a bath. A typical Saturday night on Wilhelm Street, sitting there watching probably a stolen television, drinking some beer. Your front door busts open and a guy can run in your house through your living room, dining room, kitchen, out your back door. Then here comes a police officer right behind you. Saturday Night Live entertainment on Wilhelm Street. All them houses are all roach infested. I don't care how good you clean them. You're still going to have roaches. They get in your shoes at nighttime. They get under your collar. Get in your clothes. I go to work. I'm going like this. One of them's under my collar. Just doing a little tap dance under there. Then I'm going to work one day. And a guy's looking real funny. One of the roaches got his head out of my pocket going like this. Looking at this guy while he's talking to me. I'm thinking, it's a hell of a way to have to live. We get our gas electric shut off. It's no big deal. We run extension cord out our kitchen window, down the wall, in the neighbor's window, to keep a lamp refrigerator going until we get our gas electric turned back on. That's how I lived for a couple of years. I come home drunk one night. I was renting this house $14 a week. I looked across the street, a little one-way street, and it said house for rent, $13. I moved across the street to save a buck. Yeah. I do stupid things like that. People talk about fringe benefits. Listen, I live in a nice house in a nice neighborhood today. Because I've been sober a while and I saved my money and I bought one. Paid for it. Hey, you didn't give it to me for staying sober. They taught me how to get off my tail, go get a job, work, save your money, buy a house. So I live in a nice house. One of the fringe benefits of my house today, if you walk in my house, there's a light bulb in every lamp. When I was drinking, I didn't have light bulbs in every lamp. When I was living on Wilhelm Street, we had two light bulbs, one upstairs and one downstairs. I've been picked up for shoplifting. I know it is a steal. I'd steal anything. We had a light bulb upstairs and one in the kitchen. When you're upstairs in the bedroom, you got to go to the bathroom. You take it out of the bedroom, put it in the bathroom. Come out of the bathroom, oh, it's hot. You take it out of the bathroom. Downstairs, take it out of the kitchen, put it in the living room. Now the living room, back to the kitchen. I could have stole light bulbs. That's how stupid I was. And that's how I lived for a couple of years on Wilhelm Street. And then it got bad. I got in trouble in the city, but the heat was off in the county, so I moved back to the county. I started moving these abandoned summer homes. People in the city who had money, they would take the kids out of school and they go to the country in the summer. Now they have a big river in our area called the Magathie River. And they all have all this line with these summer homes. Old summer homes back in the 50s and 60s. They weren't insulated. They were used strictly as summer homes. You take the kids out of school and like Memorial Day, move down to the beach, stay in a summer home till fall, till after Labor Day, take the kids back to the city and put the kids back in school and shut the summer home down. Summer homes had no insulation, no furnaces. Well, when they moved out, I would move in to springtime. It's nothing living there and get ready to go to the bathroom in a cold winter and look in the toilet bowl and it's frozen over. You put space heaters in there, you put whatever, you know, a kerosene stove, board the windows up, and get out of there by springtime. Then do the same thing the next fall. And just play a regular place on the summer. And that's how I was living. And finally, I was on a bad drunk in 1964. I reached a point, a lot of us reach, where you get sick and tired of being sick and tired. You've had it. You know, no one else can stand you. Now you reach a point you can't stand yourself and you don't know what to do about yourself. And I was thinking about suicide and I didn't have the courage to do it. I was afraid I'd screw that up too. I'm thinking about getting this car going as fast as I could, get it and pull it into the front of this truck. And now I'm probably just paraplegic or something, so. Through the grace of God, and I turned off, my daughter died, I turned God off. I don't hear nothing about God. To me, God was a big man in the sky with a fly swatter. Every now and then he'd smack me. And I saw a little church on the side of the road, Little white building with a cross on it. I didn't know what kind of church. I knew it was a church, though. I didn't know what kind. But I knew I needed to talk to somebody to do something before I really did something stupid. And I went in that church, and I talked to that minister. He happened to be in the church. And I told him about my life, how my life's falling apart. He said, you got a lot of problems, but your biggest problem is you're drinking. Now, I can help you with your marriage, your religion, your just a lot of things, but you got to stop. I can't help you. You got to stop drinking. I can't help you with that. But let me tell you something. I got a member of my congregation who's a member of AA. I didn't know it was AA till that day. I thought it was 3As. I thought it was Alcoholics Anonymous Association. We used to get drunk in a bar and people say, you ought to go to 3As. And we'd look up in the yellow page, Alcoholics Anonymous Association, and we always end up with AAA, the Automobile Association of America or something. I didn't know it was AA till I came here. And so he said, this guy who was had a drinking problem, went to a thing called Alcoholics Anonymous, hasn't had a drink in 7 years. And maybe he can help you. And once you get sober, then we can work on these other problems. But right now, you've got the cart from the horse. We've got to get the horse back from the cart. First things first. Now, I don't know what I had, but I didn't like what I had. So I was willing to meet Larry that night and go to a meeting. And I went to my first AA meeting, 23 years of age, in 1964. And I wasn't quite 24. Small meeting. Thank you, Bill, for taking that little meeting, you and Lynn, last night to a little meeting. It was 7 of us at this meeting last night. My home group averages 60 people at a 12 noon meeting. I appreciated this meeting last night. You can't hide in their room. You can hide in these big rooms, but you can't hide in them little rooms. And I looked around at that first meeting. It looked like everybody was 100 years old. Wasn't many women in AA back in the 60s. If the men had any hair, it was white. And I'm sitting there, 23, looking around thinking, I can't believe I'm here. And they were talking about how long they drank. I'd only been drinking like 8 years. One guy said he drank for 28 years. Another lady, she said, I drank for 33 years. And the guy, I said, do I have 38, 30, 39, do I have 40? It's like a contest, how long we drank. And I felt like, damn, I got cheated. Man, I wish I could have drank for 28 years or 35 years. Or pump drunk, burnt out, 8 years. I can't believe this. One guy said he's from New York, and the bars were open at 4 o'clock in the morning. I'm thinking, damn, I wish I could have lived in New York. They closed down at 12 o'clock where I live. I mean, 2 o'clock. Anyway, what's neat about AA? They talked about back in those days having a disease and not a disgrace. And back in the 60s, it was a disgrace to be an alcoholic. Today, it's a click thing to do. You know, call it good treatment. And I just felt like I got cheated. Now, what's neat about AA and what's neat about young people in AA? We bounce back fast. Physically, we bounce back fast. The pain doesn't last long like it does with old guys been out there pumping it for 40 years. I bounce back fast. All of a sudden, I'm feeling good. And it starts dawning on me, maybe I made a bad decision with about this AA thing coming to AA. Now, what's neat about AA, we got a lot of phonies in AA, but they'll throw none of us out. No one says, do your phony, get out of here. So I started playing games that some drunks play in AA. I'd go to meetings and remind myself I'm an alcoholic. Then I'd go out and I'd play all the games the drunks were playing. When I was the kind of guy who was drinking, I'd just walk into a bar like I own this place. Give me a drink. Now I'm sober, I sneak into the bar. Sneak up to the bar. Tell the barmaid, I just want a plain Coca-Cola. And she announces to the world, a plain Coca-Cola, real loud, like E.F. Hutton just said something. And the whole room gets quiet, and I feel like I got a big light on top of my head going, hey, you know? I said, I just want a plain Coca-Cola. Okay. I'm guys out here having a good time. I missed the action. I didn't miss the drinking as much. I missed that action. I was like a moth drawn to a flame. I missed those dances and women and the gambling, the fighting, the whole schmear. That's what I missed when I got sober. So she puts me this little bottle of Coca-Cola, little glass on my in front of me. She said, that's $2. I said, wow. Then she put this great big beer, this guy next to me, for 50 cents. Got my first resentment. He's getting all this beer for 50 cents. I'm getting a little bit of Coke for $2. Well, it didn't take me long to, because I associated with drinking people, drinking places, doing drinking things. After coming in AA, I drank. And the same thing happened to me after I came in AA. That used to happen to me before I came in AA. When I drink, I get drunk. And when I get drunk, trust me, sooner or later, maybe not today or tomorrow or the next day, but I will get into trouble. That's the story of my life. We don't make AA good behavior. We get into trouble. And I would get into trouble, and sooner or later, I got off, come off of a bad drunk, and I crawled back to AA, and I told my sponsor how sorry I was I let him down. He said, stop right there. He said, there's a bathroom down the hall with a mirror in it. I'm twice your age. Go look at you and come back and look at me and see who looks better tonight. I guarantee I look better than you do. He said, you take a drink, you let yourself down. If you want to get sober, he said, I'll go to hell and back for you. You want to take a drink, you're on your own. See you later. They gave me two guarantees. Number one, if you're an alcoholic and you're sitting here today and you're thinking about going back to drinking, see, I thought maybe I just got a sheer little bit of bad luck, trying to rationalize. I'm looking for some excuse to drink. I don't care how bad it is in your life, or if you're an alcoholic, how bad it's been and you're sober today. You take a drink, you ain't seen nothing yet. You ain't seen nothing yet. I've never heard a guy or gal who's an alcoholic sober in AA go out, take a drink, get drunk, come back, and tell me a success story. Now, everybody don't get back to AA. Some people, they see people drifting in and out, they think, well, I'll go out, I'll come on back, pick up a white chip and start all over again. Some people go out, take a drink, never get back here. They die out there before they get back. Or they commit a crime and go to prison the rest of their life. No matter how bad it is, you take another drink, you ain't seen nothing yet. It will get worse, I guarantee you. It's a progressive illness, and you're going to get worse. The other guarantee was, I don't care how bad it is, if you stop drinking, even if things don't get better, you can get better. And what they mean by that is if you can get better, you can handle the bad things that are happening in your life better. You don't have to, compound this thing with another drink. And eventually, if you keep staying here, you get better, but things eventually will get better. If they didn't keep getting better, I wouldn't come back here, I'll be honest with you. But they talk about being catapulted in the fourth dimension. I can't believe the life I'm living. Today, I'm living a very exciting life. And I was in AA like 1 week. And my sponsor said, there's a new man over there. Go talk to the new man. I said, I got 7 days. You go talk to him. What can I tell him? You got 2 years. You go talk to him. And he said, he doesn't have 7 days. Tell him about your 7 days. You're not shaking like you used to shake 7 days ago when you first came in here. He said, remember how you were shaking? I said, yeah. In fact, I told you I wanted to smoke a little dope or something just to calm me down. Get over the shakes. He said, he told me, shaking ain't going to kill you. I've never met a guy or a gal who died and they wrote on his death certificate, he shook to death. Who's the case? Shaking won't. Kind of long story short, they told me it's going to get worse if I continue to drink, and I went back to drinking despite that. And within 7 months, I was living back in the abandoned summer homes. And this one summer home I was living in, I went berserk in that house. I was 24 years of age. I went berserk in that house. I ran my fist through the doors, the windows, the walls. My arms and wrists were all cut up and going through the glass in the windows. Trying to put my head to a concrete porch. Ended up in the hospital that night. The ambulance and the police came. The next day I sat in a doctor's office where I live is around a park. And the doctor said, the doctor sewed me up that night, said, they've got to get this guy out of society. If he doesn't kill himself, he's going to kill somebody else. My doctor said, Stu, can't you just stop drinking? I said, no, in fact, I want to drink right now. He said, we're going to do something out there. So there's no treatment centers back in the 60s. So I end up into a local state mental institution, into a locked ward, where they take away your belt and your shoestrings and anything you may hurt yourself with. You eat with a soup spoon. And you're locked in, and basically you're locked into a facility, and in every door is you're like in a cage. And I was in a building called the Meyer Building at Crownsville State Hospital. And after 2 days, they do an evaluation, and they did an evaluation on me, and they said that we think you're an alcoholic and you should go to Cottage 15. I said, what do you do at Cottage 15? I'm in what is called a snake pit area, evaluation building. He said, well, you go to AA up at that cottage, and you work. I said, excuse me, I didn't come down here to go to AA and go to work. He said, fine, stay here. I spent 6 weeks in a locked ward of a state mental institution because I didn't want to go up there and go to meetings and go to work. In that locked ward, we played games with psychiatrists. We made ceramic ashtrays. We made little leather wallets. We made leather belts, even though we couldn't wear them. We had all kind of therapy, and we got tired of making ceramic ashtrays and leather wallets and little belts and things. We said, can't we do something different? They said, well, how about dancing? I said, I love to dance. And so he said, okay, let's try some dancing. It's a new therapy. So he put us, took all the crazy girls out of their room, us crazy guys out of our room, put us in a room like this, turn a record player on, said, well, go ahead and dance. I saw a cute little blonde sitting there. I said, would you like to dance? She said, I'd love to. I got my wrist all taped up, got my forehead taped up. I'm out there dancing around with this girl, good-looking blonde. I'm dancing, having a good time. She says, you tried to commit suicide, didn't you? I said, nah. She said, look at your wrist. You cut your wrist, didn't you? I said, nah, they went to a window. She said, no, you tried to commit suicide. I said, no, I never need it. I said, what are you in there for? She said, I killed my husband. I said, I might be stupid. I'm not crazy. I'm getting me a new dance partner right now. You know? And all I tell you, when I got out, the day I got out of there, I got drunk. And that was the story of my life. I was always getting drunk. And through the grace of God, I came off of a terrible drunk. March the 12th, 1966. I had been a bar in Baltimore City, down on Mount Royal and Charles Street. A bar, a real nice bar called the Bucket of Blood. And I got hooked up with this gal who, she was drunk and I was drunk. And she didn't know whether she's bisexual or lesbian, what the hell she was, but we're both looking for a woman. And we're both drunk, and we're looking for a woman. And we went to the Les Gals, and we went to the strip bars, and we're drinking. And neither one of us would find a woman have anything to do with either one of us. So her and I spent the night together at Mount Royal Hotel, where you get a room for $25. I don't know what happened in that room, but I know the next day, she had a hose or something in there, and I ended up like black and blue all over, and I had to get out of there like 5:30 in the morning. I don't know what happened. All I know is, man, she beat the hell out of me with something. I don't know what it was. So here I'm a lover, a great fancy lover. I'm in this with this bisexual, lesbian, whatever hell she is, woman. And I mean, I'm real romantic, you know. And I ended up in a bar, caught a cab down the county. And I ended up I lost my license, had my car repossessed, so I'm moving around on a cab and buses. And I now moved out of the summer home and moved close to when I come out of the mental institution, moved close to my factory. I was renting a row house up in Baltimore, close to where I worked. And a guy picked me up off a men's room floor and brought me home, and I felt so ashamed of myself. I remember coming to the front door of my house, and my wife had a shadow box mirror on the wall. And I looked in, and it looked like a monster looking back at me. And I said, God, please just don't let me go off. Don't let me go off. And I found myself, you know, shaking that drunk out over the weekend. And I found myself calling Alcoholics Anonymous, find out where a meeting was. And I hitchhiked to that meeting. And I came back, and I joined Alcoholics Anonymous March 12, 1966. I haven't had a drink or used any substitute for a drink since that day. Told my sponsor, how am I going to get these meetings? I don't have a car. He said, you didn't need a car to get drunk. You don't need a car to get sober. You get to the meetings, we'll get you home. Stay on the corner, we'll pick you up. And there weren't a lot of meetings around back in those days. And I started going to a lot of meetings, and action is the magic word. I got active. I got involved in AA. I found there was a big difference between being around AA and being in AA. It's like your bed. You go home and pull your bed out in the middle of the floor. You can walk around your bed all night long. You stand back there and look at it. Get in there, smell it, touch it. It don't mean nothing until you get in. A is the same way. I thought just come sitting in a chair at a meeting, I'm in AA. My spouse said, no, it's more. That's a good way to get started. But he said, there's more to AA than just sitting in a chair at a meeting. He said, if you think just sitting in a chair, you'll get sober by sitting in a chair at a meeting, he said, go home, put a chair in the middle of your garage, sit in that chair, and see if you turn into a car. Okay? It ain't going to happen. You're going to have to take some action. Now, I don't care who you get, Mr. or Ms. AA, for a sponsor. You can memorize the 12 steps. You can come early, stay late. You can set up chairs. You can do a lot of things. But if you don't stop drinking, baby, you ain't going to get sober. Hardest, most important thing you're ever going to do in AA is not only stop drinking, but stay stopped. It's a whole lot easier staying sober than getting sober. No one promised me a rose garden. No one said I'm going to live a happily ever after and never have a problem. Welcome to the real world. Welcome to the real world. You don't have to drink anymore. You have AA in one hand, God in another. It's hard to pick up a drink. My spouse said, learn to bend your knees before you bend your elbow. Fake it till you make it. If you don't have a guy, borrow mine. He's big enough for both of us, he said. You'll find your own. Join Alcoholics Anonymous. Go to meetings. I said, how often should I go to meetings? He said, how often did you drink? I said, I drank every night. Go to meetings every night. So I started going to meetings. I was sober almost a year, and I got I had to go down, because I ended up in a mental institution, I had to go down in front of the Department of Motor Vehicles, have a hearing in front of medical advisors, get my license back, play the game with the psychiatrist and tell him why I think I'm an alcoholic and all this stuff to get my license back. I got my license back. Now I need a car to go to meetings in. So I bought my first AA car. I bought an old taxi cab they took off the streets of Baltimore. It wasn't safe enough to carry people in. It was a veterans GI taxi cab, red, white, and blue. Old Dodge Coronet. I bought it for $50. Took the dome off the top, pushed the wires in, put some duct tape over the holes, keep the rain out. Took a little spray paint on the side of the door. It was red, white, and blue car. Veterans GI taxi cab. I painted over it. It still looked like a taxi cab. I remember taking my little girl was 3 1/2 when I got sober. And she was like 4 1/2, 5 years old. We're riding downtown to Baltimore in my taxi cab, my car. And everybody's going like this. And my little girl said, God, Dad, you're an AA. Everybody knows you now, don't they? Yeah. You learn a lot from your kids. I remember she started the first grade. She came home first day for school. I said, how'd you do at school today? She said, not too good, Dad. I got to go back again tomorrow. I said, honey, AA is the same way. We don't do too good. We got to keep coming back. So I started working. And then what happened was all the old drunks would give me their young drunks because I was only like 26 years old. And I was sober a year going to meetings. So all these old young drunks and stuff, I pile them in my taxi cab. I'm taking them to a meeting. And the first thing they say, where's all the young people at? I said, they go to a meeting on the other side of the Harbor Tunnel, a little area called Dundalk, Maryland. We're going to go there Tuesday night. I'll show you young people. Well, there's no young people in Dundalk. I take them down there to say, where are they at? I said, they must be at Catonsville Friday night meeting. I told my sponsor, I'm not lying, these guys. I'm romancing the truth just a little bit here. But I'm not lying. I'm just trying to buy them some time to make them realize age doesn't mean nothing. And I take them there Friday night, and they wouldn't be there. And I said, well, you've had a week without drink. You know, we really don't have to see other people. You can be the other people. Now, what's funny, 40 years go by. I work with a lot of old people today. I bring an old-timer, an old guy into a meeting like this. I work with guys now 50, 60 years old or so. I bring them in a room like this. They look out there, and they see all these young people. They say, where the hell is all the old people at? I said, they're in Dundalk. We'll get down Dundalk Tuesday night, and I'll show you some old people. I got active in AA. I got involved in the steps. I asked my sponsor, when should I get into these steps? He said, when do you want to get well? AA's more than just not drinking. If we don't change, AA says we're either going to grow or we're going to go. You have to change if you want to say so. Same person is going to drink again. I've got to change. I got to go through a personality change. Change of attitude. I went to a meeting one night. It was called the Beltsville Group. And they spelled the word group, GRO-UP. Grow up. I got to grow up ahead of time. I would pick up the little things that made sense to me. My sponsor, I used to ride down the road, and I was always tempted with these. I was fascinated with neon lights. They would blink on and off, on and off. It's like, come on in, come on in. In fact, they have a big sign blinking off, and I'm going, bar, B-A-R, bar, B-A. My sponsor, you know what that means? I said, what? He says, it means beware of alcohol, run. Stay out of drinking places. And I would pick up little things like that. There's so many things you can put between you and a drink if you really want to stay sober. I sponsored a lot of young people in AA. My first 3 years sober. I'm not exaggerating. I bet you I sponsored over 100 young people my first 3 years sober. And on my third anniversary, wasn't a damn one of them sober. But I was. I was trying to get them sober through the grace of Stu. He said, it doesn't work like that. They're going to get sober through the grace of God if they're going to get sober. And the minute I let go and let them, you know, grow on their own and do on their own, they started staying sober despite me. I've never taken credit for a guy's sobriety. I don't have to take a fall for his drinking. You know, I'm concerned with him staying sober. That's my main purpose. Try to get him hooked up with a higher power. He can choose to call God or whatever he wants to call it and live this kind of way of life. I've had a lot of exciting things. When I came in AA, I had a speech impediment. I used to stutter a lot. I think I'm talking fast, I don't stutter. The only thing is you got to listen fast. The other thing I couldn't see when I came today, I was always walking around squinching. My sponsor, what's the matter? I said, I can't see. He says, get some glasses. I said, I look better without them. He said, you ain't here to win a beauty contest. You're here to be sober. That's what this thing's all about. Let me tell you something. I've had a lot of success being sober. A lot of these exciting things have happened to me. Went back. I was listening to Bethany talk about getting her GED. I did all those things. I went back, got my GED. Do you know why? All my brothers and sisters graduated from high school or college except me. My father had all the diplomas hanging on the wall up in his bedroom. I'm the middle child. There's two sisters and a brother before me. A brother and two sisters before me. And then my space is blank. And he bragged about his children. Oops. So I found myself getting sober, and I went back. I got a GED. I took it down, wrapped up, and gave it to him for a Christmas present. He sat there and cried. Took it in and hung it up. He was so proud of that. And from a kid who came in who never wanted to be nothing like his father, I want to be more like my father every day of my life today. What a wonderful man he was. Two stories I'm going to tell you. I went through a divorce after 22 years of sobriety. That wasn't a pleasant thing to go through, but I did it. It was basically my fault that we went through the divorce, my behavior. I had a lot of amends to make. And Nancy and I ended up getting a divorce. She stayed very active in Al-Anon for a while. I stayed involved in AA. And it wasn't like a nasty, nasty, nasty divorce. It was just the fact that things have happened. We could no longer live together. And we decided, let's take a trial separation, see where it goes from here. And we separated. And we both signed a voluntary separation agreement of 2 years, which meant we can't jump out of a frying pan to a fire and get into another relationship or a marriage right away. I moved in with an old man in AA, an old bachelor. Moved in with him. She stayed in the house. And we were both involved working with a lot of couples and people in AA. It was big news around AA for a while back, 20-some years ago. And we decided where we will not bring this into AA. Our sponsors know about it. Our friends know about it. But we're not bringing it into AA. She said, well, I like going to security Thursday. I said, well, you go to security. I'll go to Glen Gardens. She said, well, Tuesday, I like to go to Marley. I said, you go to Marley, I'll go to Pasadena. We never went to the same meeting again. I like the state convention. I said, you go to state convention, I'll go to Blackstone. We never went to the same facility. We never crossed paths in AA. Never brought our friends into it. It didn't become a choose a side crap. It didn't get into big arguments, embarrassment. We kept that up. And so after 3 years of separation, we went and got a divorce. And neither one of us ever got married again until in the past few years, a lot of things have happened. 5.5 years ago, and we remained friends, and she calls me up. She said, Stu, she said, remember that cancer? I said, yes. She said, it came back on me. I said, wow. She said, can you get a hold of the kids and get them home here? So this is pretty serious. I said, I'll take care of all that. I said, can I come down and see what I can do, too? She said, I would like that. Meanwhile, she had a boyfriend. I got a lady friend. You know, we need one ever remarried. Anyway, cut a long story short, I get my children back. We get downstairs. She has a melanoma cancer. There's many forms of cancer that are curable, treatable, and et cetera. But she had the type that was terminal. They gave her 6 months to live. She was 60, just turned 61 in January that year. And we got involved in trying to take care of her for the next 6 months until she passed away. I told my lady friend Kathy. I said she's the mother of my children. I've known her since she's 13. I still love her as a person. I want to be there for her. She said, I expect that. I'll see you when I see you. You're retired. Do whatever you can do for her. So I would get up and go down there at 5:30 in the morning to help take care of her during the day while her girlfriends worked. When they got off work, they'd come and take care of her in the evenings. I'd go back in the morning. And I'd help take care of her for 6 months before she passed away. And I was there when she passed away. What a golden opportunity God gave me to make a living amend. To help take care of her and let her go out with some dignity. I remember one day we're sitting there and she started crying and I said, Nancy, I had never seen you cry before. She says, I went over and I hugged her and then I started crying. And I said, I just want to tell you all this. I'm sorry for all the hell I've ever put you through in my entire life. I'm here for you all the way. I wish it was me instead of you being there. She said, you know, I believe that. And I know that. But I've had a good life and I want to thank you for being here. And I forgave you a long time ago. When you can learn to forgive yourself still. And what a gift she gave me. The opportunity to stay there and take care until she passed away. To be there right to the very end. And then a few years later, in fact, it'd be 2 years ago this September. My mother died 14 years ago. And then my father He stayed in the house as long as he could, and he decided he was going to go to an assisted living home. Had a hard time getting him in there. And because he couldn't take care of himself. And I said, Dad, I said, you're going to like it in there. And he sort of looked a little bit of a ladies' man anyway. I said, Dad, there's 65 women and 10 men. His eyes lit up. After I got him in there, I couldn't get him out with a crowbar. He just fell in love with us. And they fell in love with him because he was very healthy all the way up to the end. He never used a walker or a cane or nothing until he got sick the last year and a half of his life. And about 5 years or so ago, he asked me to be a power of attorney and take care of him while he's in his final stages of his life. And all my brothers and sisters, how come you're picking him? He doesn't even have a formal education. He said, excuse me, stop right there. He said, you know why I picked him? Because I can trust him. I can depend upon him. He said, he'll be here at 3 o'clock Saturday. He'll be here at 3 o'clock Saturday. That's why I picked him. And I know he loves me and I love him. That's why I picked him. So I was able to take care of my father his last few years of his life. In fact, he got sick there in September, coming up on 2 years. And I went down and I used to go see him at least twice a week. I was always down there. And I wanted to be more like him as I grew older and stayed sober than anybody else in the whole entire world. And I went down to help take care of my father, and he got sick the last 2 days. And I was there, and he said, I'm dying. I said, Dad, I said, well, maybe it's time for you to go home and be with Mama. He said, well, I'm dying. And he went into a coma. My daughter came down from Pennsylvania, and we sat there, and we helped take care of him for almost 2 full days. And he went into a coma, taking care of him, giving him morphine, et cetera. And finally, I was kneeling beside the bed and had his head in the palm of my hand, and I'm talking to him about going home, you know, walk in the garden with Mama, Dad. It's okay to go home now. You did your job. We're okay now. And he'd been in a coma, and all of a sudden he opened his eyes up and looked at me. And like that, and he took his last breath with his palm of his head right in the palm of my hand. I thought, thank you, God. What a gift you just gave me. My father brought me in. I could take him out. What a gift. What a gift. I've had a lot of things like that happen to me as I've stayed sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. I love being with my grandchildren today. I can't see if we could be with them because they're not locally. They're out of state and all over the place. But the couple grandchildren I do have, I spend a lot of time with them. And nothing's more exciting than to go to grandparents' day at school. And you walk in the classroom and your little 7 or 8 year old granddaughter jumps up and tells everybody in the whole class, hey, there's my grandpa. There's my grandpa. Hi, Papa. What a gift. What a wonderful feeling. What a golden opportunity. Walk down the street holding your hand, thinking and telling you you're the greatest person in the whole wide world. I was blessed. I was telling some guys before the meeting. My son-in-law, when he goes on vacation, he plans for 7. He sat down and talked to me. He said, look, he said, you're the only grandparent my children have. My parents are deceased and Nancy's now gone and you're it. And we're going to take care of you. And we want you with you. I want my grandchildren to get to know the grandfather. I never had a chance to know my grandfather. So when we make plans for vacations or anywhere, it's for 7, not for 5. You're going to go. And I got remarried 4 years ago. Now, this girl, Kathy, who gave me permission to go back and take care of my wife. I thought, wow, what a gal. I've known her 20 years. She's not in the program. We didn't take each other as a hostage. I said, what do you say we get married? I said, Kathy, I'm getting older. I said, I die. You're 10 years younger than me. I said, I've known you 20 years. You've been living. We've been doing some light housekeeping here for about 12 years. I said, if I die, I said, you don't get to die from Social Security or nothing. And I know my son, he's going to come here and pick this place clean. So I said, reality of it is, let's get married. She said, I'd love to. So I went down to Annapolis Courthouse, got the license. In Annapolis, Maryland, you get married in 48 hours without a witness or anything. And we didn't have a big, I told her I'd pay for everything. Her and I went to the Justice of Peace. Little courthouse in Annapolis. We went in and a lady did the things. We got married, took our vows. We got married and it was boat week in Annapolis. It took longer to find a place to park than it was to get married. And then we went and drove up and saw her parents and told her we got married. And her mother and father was looking at the wedding certificate. They give a big wedding certificate nowadays. It used to be little. And her father said, what'd you do this time? I said, we got married. And they start crying. They were all excited. My daughter is excited. Kathy, just everybody. So we married. Got married on my daughter's birthday on October 16th, 4 years ago. Coming up on 5 years this October. been one of the nicest things happened to me in my entire life. What a great gal she is for me. And here again, we didn't take each other as a hostage. My life is exciting, trust me. I don't have time to get into it, but we were talking before the meeting with Al. The place is my son-in-law. He says he's going to take care of me. Trust me, he's taking care of me. My son is very successful. Happened somewhere along the line, once in a while, in a good family. And I'm on a fixed income with Social Security and a little pension I got from the factory and some other stuff I did along the way. And he's very successful. He was president of sports entertainment for a large company with, he had 175 vice presidents under him and 68,000 employees. So he started, he said, I have to attend all these different athletic functions like Super Bowl games and All-Star games and home run derbies and basketball finals. Would you mind going with me? He said, we're going to have to fly first class now and we're going to stay in suites and things like this. I said, I think I can handle that. I mean, I've been to Super Bowl games, All-Star game, home run derbies. I'll tell you what. He said, you want a wild weekend? I'm going to share this with you. He's talking about rocking in fourth dimension, even though it doesn't mean this. He said, be at my house Friday night. Saturday morning, we're going to fly out of Philadelphia, and we're going to Las Vegas, and we're going to have ringside seats to Oscar De La Hoya, Bernard Hopkins championship fight. Ringside seats. We'll spend the night in Las Vegas. Next morning, we're going to drive into L.A. We drove into L.A., checked into a hotel, the Hilton Hotel. 3 o'clock in the afternoon, this great big limousine, as long as this hallway, picks us up and takes us to the Emmy Awards. We get out the red carpet. I'm walking up the red carpet with a nice black suit on, a nice white shirt, a nice tie and everything. Walking up the red carpet with all the movie stars and celebrities like I'm somebody. You know what I mean? I started laughing. He said, what's so funny? I said, this is a hell of a long way from Franswell State Hospital to make a ceramic ashtray, you know? And then we left there, went to the governor's ball. And we left there. The next day, we flew back to Philadelphia and had a suite for us to go watch the Eagles play the Vikings. I've had a lot. I've been inside. I went to the Yankee-Boston series. I've been inside the Green Monster Wall. I've had a lot of exciting things happen to me. A lot of nice things like that. He quit the job a year and a half ago. I said, oh, my God, my world's come to an end. I said, no, it's been a great ride. It's been a great ride. If I never go to another sporting event in my entire life, it's been a great ride. I've had a chance to take a lot of A guys to these functions. He gave me a whole suite full of tickets or something. I call these guys up. Meet me down the stadium. I got us a suite with a chef. I got everything. Parking spaces, you know. What a ride it was. And he takes me down to the Caribbean every year. He rents a villa. We stay in this big villa. And he's sitting down there. We're down in Barbados last year. And he says, well, the party's over. I said, wow. I said, but it was a great ride. So he comes home. I said, nah, it's been a good ride. I said, I appreciate everything. I've done things. A bunch of guys I sponsor have lived through their dreams through me. So I come back, and a couple weeks later, he calls me up, and he says, I got thinking about, you're not going to a lot of sporting events, and we need to do something about that. He said, I'll tell you what I did. Your daughter and I decided we're going to buy you something special. I said, what are you talking about? He said, well, remember when your daughter Dawn, my wife, was 16, you bought her orange Beetle convertible for her 16th birthday. She got her license. I said, yeah. He said, I knew you couldn't afford that, but you did it for her. She could never get over that. He said, we bought you something. And I went out. He said, it's out in the garage. Where I said, a buddy of mine has this used Corvette. He can't get a decent price for it, what he wants. He said, he'll sell it to me what they offered him at the dealership. So we bought this little yellow Corvette out there in the driveway. That's for you to have. You've never had nothing like that in your entire life. You've always wanted something like it. You could never afford nothing like that. This is for you. Thanks for being a great father-in-law. Wow, I start crying. This is AA. You know, I can never get back to AA what AA has given to me. The greatest gift that I enjoy mostly, I'll be honest with you, is working with drunks. Coming down here, you don't know how much I appreciate staying in your place. Bill kept telling me that it's just an old trailer. No, it's not an old trailer. It's a home. It's full of love. This past November, he took me to Maui. We stayed at Four Seasons, $1,000 room, a night for a room. I'd give all that up to stay one night with you. And that's what it's all about. It's about the fellowship, about the friends that we meet along the way, that we never met if we went to Alcoholics Anonymous. You're a wonderful life man. You know, I was in the shower this morning. She puts a note on my bed about my wife calling, about her mother having a stroke. So I got to take care of that tonight. But just coming here and getting sober and saying sober is the greatest thing happened to me in my entire life. And you're not going to miss it all like that by taking a drink. We don't have a maid. We got a maid just for today. There's no seniority in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've seen guys with a lot of sobriety forget where they came from. Didn't do the homework. All of a sudden, don't have time to go to AA. Quit going to meetings. Oh, they'll go to a function. They'll go to a convention. They'll go to a banquet. They won't go to the regular meeting. You know, I ask myself all the time, when's the last time I worked with a new man? I enjoy sitting down talking with you two young guys this weekend, today. These two guys today. When's the last time you, I'm closing with this. When's the last time you talked to a new person? When's the last time you offered a new person a ride to a meeting? When's the last time you quit shooting a breeze about a football team and sat down and give a drunk a little bit of your time? Grace, your time is the greatest gift you can give anybody. Give them a ride. Give them the time. Someone was there for you. Be there for them. Pass that on. You know what's wrong with me? I get carried away talking. My first year sober, I went to Bill Wilson's anniversary in New York. What a gift. Another gift. Talk about rocking in the fourth dimension. I went up and I heard Bill Wilson tell the story in 1966. That morning, him and Lois met us in a little room, speaking on a little platform about AA, and we all had a chance to get in a big circle, go around the room, walk up, shake their hand, and talk to each one of them for a few minutes. And I'll never forget, I told Bill, I want to thank you for letting God use you as an instrument to find the program to save my life. And all he said was, pass it on. So when's the last time you really passed it on? I went back 3 more years to his anniversary before he died. What a gift. What a gift. Talk about dreams being past your wildest dreams. I can't believe my life. The fact I can walk, I can get in my car, ride down the road, enjoy life. And feel good about myself. Looking in the mirror, looking at the guy, looking back at you, say, hey, you're okay today. A lot of improvement to work on, but you're okay today. You're not what you used to be. So anyway, God bless you, and thank you for allowing me to come down here and share with you. And I hope you have another good, successful one of these next year. I've enjoyed it. Thank you.